Hello and welcome to the March 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynemouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor, and Lorraine Ferguson joins me this month to co-anchor the programme. You won't believe it, but British summertime starts on the 26th of this month.
It still feels like winter, given the freezing temperatures we've had recently. Thank goodness for my hot water bottle. I remember the stone one I had as a child. My nan used to knit multicoloured covers to prevent me touching the burning hot stone. Here's a poem by J.J. Evenden, from the hot water bottle's point of view. Being a hot water bottle is not easy. You need to have your head screwed on, you see. For if not, and are full of hot water inside, you'll give someone a rather wet surprise. So it's important not to be nervous, as by all accounts you're impervious. So take my head and screw me tight. That way I can assure you of a pleasant night.
Ah, the beloved hot water bottle. Let's have a look at what we have in store for you in this month's roundabout. Jenny Jenkins recently met up with Tynemouth veterinary acupuncturist Kate Rew, and we will be sharing their conversation with you. This will be followed by Kate's choice of music.
Babs Astley will be sharing one of her poems. Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be discussing the book they have read recently.
Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker.
John Townsend is back with part three of his interview with trombonist Peter Smith. Part one of this interview appeared in the November roundabout and part two in the January roundabout. This will be followed by Peter's choice of music.
Fran Frank will be giving some healthy hints on diet and lifestyle, and you, Lorraine, will be reading the final chapter of your friend Gilly Pugsley's diary of your trip to Iceland.
Valerie Forrester will be giving an update on our fundraising concert that took place on the 18th of February at the Shaftesbury Theatre. We will then have a piece of music to conclude the programme.
We start off with Jenny and her guest.
Hello, today I'm very pleased to introduce a very interesting friend with a most unusual career. Hello, Kate Rew.
Hello, Jennifer, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and I can't wait to hear your story. I believe you were born in Adelaide and grew up in Adelaide, Australia, the capital, mm-hmm. and on a very special date, Christmas Eve in 1967. Let's start off with your school life, because you enjoyed that and left at 16. That was after you'd finished your matriculation, wasn't it?
Yes, I went to school in South Australia to a lovely school called Westminster, where I studied lots of sciences to get into veterinary school. That was always my aim, right from when I was about 5 years old. I managed to achieve the grades and then got into university and went to Melbourne University.
Well, what did you do after that?
Well, before that, I decided to take a gap year and went to live in London.
Oh, what were you doing in London?
Well, completely different from being a vet. I actually worked as a nanny and looked after four children in Wandsworth in London, mm-hmm. on the River Thames, on a pub on the River Thames. And I shared a house there with all the girls that worked behind the bar, so you can imagine that was a bit of fun.
Quite different as well.
Yeah.
That lasted a year, and then you went back to Australia, didn't you?
Back to Melbourne, to the University of Melbourne, where I started to do my veterinary degree. So I spent 5 years doing that.
Gosh.
Which was hard work, but in the end, graduated in 1990, I think that was, mm-hmm. December 1990. We have different school years. And worked for a little while in South Australia, but then decided I wanted to go back to the UK because I enjoyed myself so much in my gap year. Got a job in South Molton up in North Devon.
Oh, wonderful. And what were you doing there It's a mixed practice, I believe.
Yes, it was my first proper job, really, working in a lovely mixed practice, very mixed. I had lovely partners in the practice that were very, very supportive of me as a new graduate, which gave me a good start to my veterinary career. So a good base of knowledge, treating all sorts of creatures, great and small, really.
My children used to call that series All Creatures Grunt and Smell.
True.
Wrong. But I think you met your future husband there, didn't you? And what was he doing?
Well, I actually met him when I first got here, within 3 weeks of arriving in the UK, so I was a bit of a fast worker. But then I met him in Dawlish at a barn dance, actually, when I was staying with some friends while I was having my job interview.
Yes.
To work in South Moulton. So, yeah, was travelling up and down from North Devon, but we ended up getting married in 1993. So, yeah, that was quite fast work too. And that was actually in Australia. We went back to Australia and got married.
Oh, don't hang around, do you? I mean, in here, meeting here, marrying in Australia, coming back here. And what was his background of farming?
He was a farmer, he is a farmer, in Dawlish Water. So it was a mixed beef and arable. And there were sheep originally, there aren't any more, but yeah, beef, sheep and arable farm, 500-acre organic farm, which was lovely. I always wanted to marry a farmer and be a vet, and I managed to achieve that by 1993. So, yeah, and it was lovely, yeah. But then, you know, it was quite difficult as well, because what a lot of people don't realise that farming is a way of life, and it can be quite a hard way of life, hard work, not much pay.
Very.
And then on top of that, we had a couple of farming crises to throw in there, which was BSE firstly, and then foot and mouth after that. So that was quite tough.
Remind me what BSE is.
Bovine spongiform encephalopathy.
Oh, well, I did know that, really. Sounds rather horrible.
Yeah, it was pretty hard for the farmers, actually, that
apart from getting on with that, it's UK's first veterinary acupuncture course was involving you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I had my children, and Lizzie was born in 1996 and David in 1998. And because I obviously didn't have enough to do, I decided to do a postgraduate qualification in veterinary acupuncture up at the Langford Vet School at University of Bristol. And I completed that. And then I actually had been working in Dawlish. When I moved down to Devon, I taken a job working in Dawlish with Frank Noble, and he was very supportive of me doing acupuncture. Mm-hmm. And I started doing that in practice and then went on to do the postgraduate qualification, as I say, up at Langford, which allowed me to start doing consultancy referral work.
Brilliant.
When the kids were small, which was good because it was a bit more flexible.
Yeah.
And so I could work that around children. I did a little bit of part-time work still in general practice. And that's where the sort of acupuncture work started. And it worked. It works. And I've made a career of it since. So, yeah.
Well, this is how we became on a common subject, because in a previous life, I too, having been a nurse, turned into an acupuncturist after a 3-year training. How long was your training course?
Well, you have to be a vet to do veterinary acupuncture. So you have to do your 5-year basic, obviously, degree. But then it was 2 years postgraduate, but it was complicated because we had speakers where our lecturers had to come over from America at that point.
But you did it.
I did you it. Did and it. We actually then, myself and a few of the other people that had done the American course, decided that we would start the first UK acupuncture course, UK run through the ABVA, which is the Association of British Veterinary Acupuncturists.
Well, I think when I qualified in 1980, there were only 200 of us in this country, acupuncturists fully trained.
You're
a rarity.
Not so much now, because I think, you know, things go on, don't they? But
yes.
Yeah, I think since bringing the course to the UK, a lot more vets within the UK could obviously qualify in basic acupuncture.
It's a bit like doctors do courses to use acupuncture and physios here, but it's interesting to compare notes and methods of doing it. So we won't go into that now. We're going to move on, because I do understand very briefly that it was tough on your marriage.
It was. And also, I did start a veterinary practice because the acupuncture and sort of pain management goes alongside veterinary rehabilitation. So I worked a lot with physiotherapists in taking spinal cases, etc. I built a rehabilitation centre, the first one.
Oh, where was that?
That was at Dawlish Water, right next to the farm. We had some land there, which I developed the barns on, and we built a veterinary practice.
Goodness.
Which was amazing, and I'm glad we did it, but it was hard on the marriage, both that and all the farming crises and everything else. So unfortunately, Nick and I did end up separating and then divorcing.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then you did move around Tynmouth a little bit, didn't you, and ended up with your own home.
Yeah,
which was
eventually.
Well, yes, it's a long and winding road, brings the title of a song to mind.
Yeah, maybe we should have that one at the end. Yeah, I moved to Tynmouth in 2010. I just rented to start with, ended up buying my own property a few years later up at the Mount.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were tenant farmers on the farm, so we never really owned that property. So it was always a bit of nothing was ever permanent. But it was very nice eventually at the age of 50 to be able to buy my own home in Tynmouth, which I loved. And yeah, I met my current partner, or should I say fiancé, in 2010 when I moved to Tynmouth. We had a lot of common interests, rowing, art, same as you, Jenny, there too. I know you know him as well. Yeah, so 12, nearly 13 years later. Yeah, yeah, we sold our properties in Tynmouth and we moved to Bishop Stainton.
Which we love.
We've been there 4 years and we're not going anywhere now. That's where we're staying.
Well, just to get us up to date, because we've only got a little bit of time left, unfortunately. What is your life like now, your weekly life? How many days do you...
Life's perfect now. I work 3 days a week.
Of course, I tip. 3 days a week. And where is that now?
And I do consultancy work sort of through the West Country. I used to cover the area from Plymouth right up to Taunton, but I've now just do sort of more local and Taunton. Yeah, I very much enjoy that. And then I spend a lot of time in my veggie patch and some time with our grandchildren and our, four big dogs and four puppies we have at the moment. Oh. So life's pretty busy and pretty lovely. Yeah.
And cosy.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Oh, that is lovely. And I congratulate you on having achieved so many things. Admirable, admirable.
Hard to get into 10 minutes.
Well, before we say goodbye, I have to ask you for a piece of music that you'd like to play us out with and the reason why you chose it.
Well, I love George Ezra because he's a great guy and a brilliant singer and musician. And I love his song, Green, Green Grass, Blue, Blue Sky. Because it's a very positive song, even though it talks about the day you die and having a party. But I love a party and none of us get out of this alive at the end of the day, so you might as well celebrate life. And I just think the song's fantastic, so that's my favourite at the moment.
All right, well, it will be arranged, and I just can't say thank you enough for coming along, Kate. I know it's been a busy day for you, and you rang me and said your road had been blocked off as well. And
through life flood water and road blockages.
Life in the fast lane doesn't faze you at all, does it?
No, I prefer it really that way.
And now I've got the brilliantest of news that you only told me very recently, that Wally and you are getting married on the 26th of January, which is Australia Day.
We are.
And I won't say where in case the marauding hordes come.
We've already got about 200 people for the last minute wedding, but yeah.
But he's still doing it here and not in Australia.
No, the last one was in Australia. We do this one here. It's just much easier. So yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Well, huge congratulations, and may your future be everything that you dream of.
Thank you, Jenny.
And goodbye to our listener.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye. But she moves like lightning, and she counts to three. Then she turns out all the lights and says she's coming for me. Now put your hands up, this is a heist, and there's no one in here living gonna make it out alive. Load it up when the sun comes down. Getaway car for two young lovers. Me and the girl straight out of town. Over the hills and undercover, undercover, undercover. Say, green, green grass, blue, blue sky, you better.
to your lovers. Me and the girl straight out of town. Over the hills and undercover, undercover, undercover. She said, green, green grass, blue, blue sky. You better throw a party on the day that I die. Green, green grass, blue, blue sky. You better throw a party on the day that I die. Throw a party. Undercover, undercover. She said, green, green grass, blue, blue sky. You better throw a party on the day that I die. Green, green grass, blue, blue sky. You better throw a party on the day that I die. Green, green grass, blue, blue sky. You better throw a party on the day that I die.
That song was Green Green Grass, Blue Blue Sky by George Ezra. It's what we've been yearning for these past several months. We seem to have a hint of spring every now and then the weather changes. Well, here is Babs Astley to remind us of what spring is actually like in her aptly entitled poem.
Spring. Spring is the infant of the seasons, when everything is new. The buds and leaves begin to grow, and the sky is a newer blue. New life begins as buds show their faces, forcing their way out in the sun. Still rather weak, but gathering strength, it watches them open one by one. Blades of new grass and flower shoots all promise a life that is long. Even the sea has tides that are spring, and birds are bursting with song. Birds gather food and feather their nests to prepare for the family to come. Their eggs are now laid and need warmth and attention, and tender loving care every one. Snowdrops and primroses force their way up, out of the soil clean and new. Their delicate petals held proudly on stems which in the mornings glisten with dew. Baby birds escaping out of their shells, their parents busy caring, finding food and keeping them warm, their chores they're always sharing. Like an infant, spring takes its first wobbly steps, its first words begin to form. Nature expands and promises much. The days begin to get warm.
Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald have been reading A Place Called Winter by Patrick Gale and are here to review it. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been reading A Place Called Winter by Patrick Gale. It was an interesting book, very historical in a way, because it was for us 100 years ago. Turns out that it's based on truth. Had I read that part of the back blurb first, it would have made more sense to me. But unfortunately, I read all the paid up stuff on the very back of the critics who went into raptures about its hidden detail and its devotion. Anyway, I enjoyed it. That's the main thing. It started off, I was a little bit, shall we say, cautious. The main character, Harry, is a lovely man. He's just charming and sweet and very much of his class and period. He doesn't do anything. He's a, eldest son. He has plenty of money to live the life of the idle young man. He loves his brother, who is completely different, much more outgoing. He has no real interest in girlfriends, but he's quite well liked and gets on very well with the ladies. It's a very pleasant start once you get into it.
Yeah, well, this is essentially a gay love story.
Yes.
At the end of the day. And it's, in many respects, quite a conventional story in terms of two people meeting obstacles in their way and so on. But what makes it interesting is that it's set in Edwardian England going into the 1920s. It's
the
First World War era.
First World War and,
therefore being gay was illegal.
Illegal.
And that, of course, provides interesting backdrop to the story. This is a man who's married, has children, but has to leave in a hurry because his sexuality is discovered. And he goes to Canada, where he becomes a farmer. He completely reinvents his life. And it's about the people he meets there and his life there. And there are ups and downs, but ultimately a happy ending.
It is. It is. And again, all that adversity in going to Canada, the journey, the things that happened to him, and actually being in Canada, proves yet again what a really nice chap he is.
Well, he's nice, but he's very, very wimpy.
He's very what, sorry?
Wimpy.
He's just a little bit.
Stuff just happens to him. He doesn't ever seem to fight back.
He never sees
him coming, either. Yeah, I'd like to see him a bit more spirit. He's one of these central characters where he just sort of goes with what happens. He accepts what happens to him. And there's very little spirit in him. Very nice guy, but from a book point of view, from a hero of a book point of view, I didn't find him quite so
He's
appealing.
Not heroic.
Not remotely.
He's quite brave at times, though. But I think as well, that is part of the makeup of young men of that era. And the fact that because of his situation in his emotional state, he has to know that he must be careful. Nothing can be shown. Of course, the ultimate happy ending is a lifesaver and a life changer for him. It really is. It gives him what he was missing, but it gives him security, protection, and it gives him the person he's devoted to.
What makes it interesting is that you get the history of the time. And there's a section of a music hall, and there's the stuff about the railway in Canada when they're building the railway and exploiting all this wild land and converting it into farms. And you get that as well as the story. And I always find historical novels interesting from that point of view because you learn the history as well as it just being a rattling good story.
I did too. I found that it was quite impressive, really, because you in some books you have no sense of the surroundings. This was very clear about the surroundings and the town. And when I discovered, when I got to the very end and read that last acknowledgements page and realised that it was all entirely based on truth, these are real people. What happened to that person, this relative of the author, was, with a bit of license, was in actual fact.
Yeah, and it's also, I think it's fair to say, very beautifully written.
It is.
This is a pleasure to read, just yes. Purely from the English and the way he uses the language. He's a very accomplished writer.
Very visual. Yes, I enjoyed it. I did.
We now have Aileen with her letter from a dog walker.
Dear listener, how time flies. When you receive this letter, it will be March, and we will officially have passed from winter into spring. On the last Sunday of February, Honey Bear and I awoke to a beautiful sunrise and the promise of a fine, dry day, which was confirmed by the weather forecast after the morning news. It was certainly too nice to sit around indoors, so it was decided that we would have an adventure by bus to St. Mary Church. The number 22 arrived on time at the nearby bus stop, and Honey Bear and I settled at the back of the bus to enjoy the journey over the bridge to Sheldon and along the winding coastal road, passing a busy Labrador Bay car park overlooking the blue expanse of Lyme Bay. Past Maidencombe, Brunel Manor, and at the start of Torquay Golf Course, the bus turned briefly inland and soon arrived at the centre of St. Mary Church. Our destination. After checking the return times of the bus, we strolled up the gentle incline of 4 Street, which is closed to traffic, and enjoyed window shopping and meeting lots of other dogs out for a stroll in the sunshine. Near the top, on the left, on Priory Road, stands the Catholic Church with a tall, pointed spire and the wonderful name of Our Lady, Help of Christians and St. Denis. At the very top of 4 Street stands the parish church of St. Mary, which has a tall, square bell tower. Both churches were visible to mariners at sea. At the end of Petiter Road, we crossed over to a park where Honey Bear was free to run and enjoy new scents. The bottom of the park borders the coastal path, which disappears steeply into trees in the direction of Sheldon. We turned right and eventually arrived in the car park beside Babbacombe Model Village. Our loop around St. Mary Church had taken over an hour. Our return bus was due to depart in 10 minutes, so we sauntered to the bus stop, and it was not long before we were on our way home for a refreshing cup of tea and a drink of water for Honey Bear. Although the weather has been sunny and bright, there is still a bite to the wind and a need for a warm coat and sometimes a hat for comfort on our wanderings. One of our favourite walks, as you know, is through Love Lane to Eastcliff Path and down through Mules Park to listen to the sea. It gives Honey Bear a nice long lead-free ramble away from the danger of traffic. At least it did until recently, when, to aid new investigations into cliff stability on behalf of Network Rail, a contractor laid solid metal matting from one side of the park to the other. Heavy drilling machinery was then able to pass without churning up the grass, and so it remained for around 3 weeks. Signs warned all walkers to be aware of possible traffic movements. Once completed, and with only a locked white metal box to show for their endeavours, the machinery and then the matting were removed, revealing a wide yellow track where the mats had been. The protected grass, starved of sunlight, had lost its colour. The grass will, of course, recover, and before long no trace will remain. But it did set me thinking how much everything needs direct or indirect sunlight to survive. This year's subject for the Flower Festival at St. Michael's, Tynmouth, is creation. Michelangelo, when he painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, saw creation as the hand of God touching the hand of Adam. I, however, have chosen the volcano, But seeing the effect on the grass of the lack of sunshine, I wondered if anyone had chosen the sun as their title. All participants must now decide just what form their flower arrangement will take. Of course, a lot depends on the available flowers at the time. During the days of the festival, towards the end of June, there is a programme of music. If I get this in advance of my June letter, I will let you know, as it is very pleasant to sit among scented flowers and listen to music. Kindest regards, the Dog Walker.
Here's John Townsend in the concluding part of his conversation with Peter Smith.
I'm pleased to say we're back again for my third and final chat with Peter Smith, a professional trombonist in many orchestras and bands for the last 7 decades. And I believe one of the special events for you, Peter, was the opening of the new Coventry Cathedral in the early 1960s.
Yes, indeed. It was Sir Basil Spence, of course. He was the builder of the beautiful cathedral, and we were engaged to do all the sound trials, which was a very exciting day. And we played in different groups in different parts of the cathedral, up and down, at the back, at the front, at the side. And it was a wonderful day. But the highlight for me was when three organists sat on the organ bench and with their hands and feet, that's six of each, press them down on the pedals and keyboard at double 40. So you can imagine the sound that made. And my trombone player pal next to me said, "Sir Basil Spence is here, and if it isn't right, he probably will say to himself, 'Oh, I should have put the wall further back that way,' something like that." But it was a wonderful experience to do.
Presumably, the acoustics in that building are spot on.
Yes, indeed. In fact, most cathedrals I've worked in, it's a joy to play.
Yes.
The resonance of the cathedral, especially with a choir, it is the most joyous way to play the trombone.
Yes, I'm sure it is. And I know you've played often in the Exeter Cathedral, which we'll come to a bit later with your work in Devon. But I think later in your career you were working in London and had, a connection with the Chelsea Pensioners. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. My then wife was made the matron of the Royal Hospital Chelsea, which incidentally was built in 1692 by Wren, and it was a very, very high position. And of course, I was the first ever Mr. Matron, because all the matrons are usually Queen's Alexandra nursing spinsters. They're never married. And so I was the first ever Mr. Matron. Now, Karen wasn't connected at all with the military. She was a civilian, but her parents were steeped in the army. But when we got there, and I was 62 at the time she got the job, so I chose to have something, if I'm going to move to London, which I did, to live in this beautiful Wren house at the Royal Hospital Chelsea, I would change career or add to my career. So what I did, I went to the Lawn Tennis Association and I became a tennis coach. And I was qualified for 20 years and I retired at 82. But all through that period in London, I was so privileged to be introduced to military bands. I played in the police band as a young man, but here we were at the Royal Hospital Chelsea, and they had their own military band within the hospital. And I was so privileged because everyone had served in the army and had got an army pension, and the average age was 84, but they allowed me to wear the mess kit. We call it mess kit in music. It's a red jacket. And I was allowed to wear the badge of the Royal Hospital, whereas all the other men would have lifeguards, blues and royals, grenadier guards, coastguard guards. So I had this wonderful opportunity, and they made me the librarian and fixer. So in other words, I could take engagements, and we could travel. I played at Windsor. That's a lovely story about Princess Anne, because I was so privileged. I was introduced to the Queen, Prince Philip. The Lady Thatcher had her own pew in the chapel. Every High Sunday I was presented to royalty and things like this. But I was playing at Windsor, and our musical director was called Colonel Duncan Beat. Can you imagine
very
that?
It's
so appropriate. He was in charge of the Scots Guards Band, but he became the head of music at the Royal Hospital Chelsea. And we were playing away. It was a lovely day. And suddenly, out of the blue, unbeknown to Colonel Beat, Princess Anne walked through with an entourage of about five people. And of course, he didn't know. And he said to the band, "What have we got in the pad? What music have we got?" Well, and the only march we had, John, was "The Old Grey Mare, She Ain't What She Used to Be, Ain't What She Used to Be." And we played it right through. And she came over to us, and she was helpless. She said to Colonel B, "Colonel B, where did you get that idea from? It was brilliant." He said, "Mom, it was the only piece we had in the pad to march into."
Well, just as well she appreciated it.
And she, of all royals, I've met them all, Princess Di and everything. Yeah. But Anne, even today, works 7 days a week, every day, in all different charities.
Yeah.
And she, of all of them, the Queen was lovely too, but she was such a lovely, happy and funny, you know, she loved laughing, and she was fab, and she took the mickey out of herself a lot, you know. She was very nice.
Great memories. And of course, well, Lady Thatcher, I know that you had some dealings with Dennis, didn't you?
Yes, well, we're on a High Sunday, you're all ponced up, and they've got their busbies on and all this, and you've got your tails on. I had to buy a pair of grey tails when she got this job. I've got black tails, of course, for my orchestras, but you have to wear, if it's the daytime, you wear grey. It's called a morning suit. It's a grey tails. And I went to a charity shop in Cheltenham, and I got these wonderful tails. They're very rare in a charity shop. But what would happen is we'd do this service, and then we'd all process into the In Pensioners Club, where there's lots of drinking, there's a big bar, beautiful place. And Dennis was notorious for being the first there. He was a very funny man. And he told us that while he does gigs for Margaret, if she can't open a garden for it, he might cover her. And he said, "I always travelled first class." And I got to Waterloo Station, and there was no first class seat available at all. And I had to go. I got my Financial Times, my suit on. I had to go. And he noticed the carriage. And it was empty, and it had for psychiatric patients only. So he thought, "I'll get in there." Well, he sat there in the corner. Sure enough, the train set off. It stopped at the first station and impaled a dozen psychiatric patients with a man in charge of them, you see, who decided he would do a roll call to make sure they're all there. So he's counting away. One, two, three. Comes to Dennis Thatcher. He said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm the Prime Minister's husband." He said, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Oh, what a great story.
That's the story he told us, but whether it's true.
Oh, I hope it is.
I do as well.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's a good story. I know you're a one for stories, and one of your, I suppose, heroes is Sir Thomas Beecham, the conductor.
Yes, sadly I never played for Sir Thomas because he was before my time, but if you read his book, there are lots of anecdotes, but the one of my favourite is my own son is an opera singer, so I know that tenors, when they hit that high note, they hang on to it. Well, this particular drama was the tenor has to sing the aria with the orchestra playing, and they pull a swan across for him to climb into, to be taken off to wherever.
Yeah.
Anyway, he hung on to the note that long on this performance that the orchestra had finished and the swan had gone through. It had gone And Beecham turned to the first violin, Martin Milner. He said, "What time's the next swan?" Which I thought was a lovely thing.
Oh, great.
And yeah. he was working with the Huddersfield Choral Union. And the rehearsal was going so badly. And anyway, they had a cup of tea and the alcohol all came back. And it suddenly started working. It was beautiful. And he turned to Martin Milner and he said, "Don't look now, but I think we're being followed."
Which I thought was very good. Now, you bringing things more up to date, you're now living in Devon and you've done quite a lot of work south Devon, in Tynmouth, and I think you've played in
Exeter,
the and the Great Hall at the
yes, that's right,
to the university. Tell us about you were involved with some work, I think, to commemorate the centenary of the First World War.
Yes, it was the Battle of the Somme. What happened, they discovered some very old films, sepia black and white films from the Somme Battle by two people who were there. They found them and they cleaned them up, really cleaned them up. And a lovely lady in Timbers, I can't remember her name, she wrote music to accompany the black and white scenes because there's no sound on it. And she did a click track, so the conductor tick, tick, tick. So the whole thing is rhythmical. And I was engaged in an orchestra. We had four trombones, two tubas, five trumpets, loads of violins, cellos, basses, clarinets, and an enormous collection of musicians. And the highlight for me, behind me, were eight timpani, you know, very large kettle drums, the very big ones, for the explosions in the pictures.
Yes.
And the first performance we did was in Exeter Cathedral, and you couldn't move. There were so many hundreds of people there. And we had to have little stand lights to read our music so that the audience weren't put off by the lights because the black and white movie's on. And the conductor had a baton with a little light on it so we could see where we were in the music. And then we did another performance of that film and music in your hometown, Tynmouth. And I gather now it's going all around the world.
Yeah,
the Battle
fantastic.
Of the Somme.
Yes. Well, I was there at that performance at the pavilions, so I'll ask for your autograph later.
Really,
and,
John?
That was really good. And look, time is racing ahead.
I know, Peter. And I've enjoyed it so much.
No, well, thank you for sharing this with us. We normally end with a piece of music of your choice. Thank you so much for talking to us. No. We're actually going to play Peter's second musical choice, as his first would last over an hour and a half to play. So this is his favourite brass band, the Grimethorpe Colliery Band, playing his favourite brass arrangement of Elgar's Nimrod from the Enigma Variations.
Fran Frank is here with some healthy hints on diet and lifestyle.
Hello, Fran Frank here. You may remember a couple of months ago when I talked about various ways of staying positive. During my research, I came across a few other suggestions that may also help you stay mentally and physically fit during these difficult times. For example, our diet can affect our blood sugar levels, which in turn has an impact on our mood. Refined carbs cause a roller coaster ride which can end with a crash, leaving you low in energy. Slow-release carbs, such as whole grains, fruit, and vegetables, can leave you feeling happier, more focused, and sometimes with more energy. Vitamin B is one of the nutrients that can help combat depression and boost your mood, especially vitamin B6, which helps to raise levels of serotonin, which is known as the body's natural feel-good chemical. So trying to include vitamin B into your regular diet is a good idea if you can achieve it. Petting or talking to an animal has also been proven to release feel-good hormones in the brain and can also reduce stress. In addition to spending time with animals, find something or someone who makes you laugh. Whether it's Reggie Perrin or Basil Fawlty, or even watching your own cat or dog chase its tail. Having a good laugh can help to lift your spirits. Most of us would acknowledge that tiredness can sometimes make you irritable. So when you are having difficulty sleeping, try to relax your muscles from the tips of your toes all the way up your body towards your head and shoulders. Not only will this distract you from thinking about anything else that may be worrying you, but it may also help release some of the tension. Before you nod off completely, though, remember to avoid putting yourself under too much pressure in the first place. Some people make lists of what they want or need to do, which is fine if this method suits you. But how about turning this idea on its head every so often, and at the end of a day or week, list those things that you have actually achieved? For example, done some washing, phoned a friend, gone for a walk along the beach, or listened to this month's edition of Roundabout. You can then go off to sleep, knowing that you managed a variety of things without too much pressure. Sleep tight until next time.
Those were very helpful hints from Fran, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Having a to-do list can be either a piece of paper, or these days you can have your own voice recording on a smartphone, iPad or tablet. Let's find out what Lorraine and her friend Jilly Pugsley got up to in the final chapter of Jilly's diary.
Two Blondes and a Spoon to Iceland by Jilly Pugsley. Chapter 5, The Blue Lagoon. It was our last day and we'd packed and breakfasted early so that we could wait in reception for the coach to the Blue Lagoon. We were accompanied by a West Midlander of indeterminate age and her very strange partner. I preferred not to engage them in conversation, conscious that my natural sense of humour might cause upset. Anyway, I didn't take to them. She was a real know-all and got on my nerves. Lorraine was slightly kinder and joined in the conversation, which was mainly one-sided, Lorraine doing a passable impression of an inarticulate goldfish. Thankfully, we lost them at the bus station and joined a charming man from Bath with his Amazonian wife. Must be a limerick in there somewhere. They obviously hadn't come prepared for the cold, both sporting light jackets, thin summery trousers, and casual walking attire. Still, as he put it, we haven't ventured out too much. We guessed they hadn't inspected the cabbages at the botanical gardens. We're in the first coach to reach the Blue Lagoon. First impression, it's a bit of a quiche tourist trap. Perswaller had competently kept back just enough krona to hire two towels. Hurrah! We're given plastic wrist straps for lockers to store our hand luggage and told to shower before entering the lagoon. Merde! Outside it's bleeding freezing and we hightail it to the steaming water. Oh, nirvana! It's hotter than bathwater, but the bottom's uneven and quite dangerous, and that's just mine and Lorraine's. I cling to the side while Lorraine boldly strikes out in a fast crawl towards the opposite bank. Bleeding show-off. Sharon Davies, eat your heart out. Lorraine's swift and heroic circumnavigation of the lagoon has revealed a waterfall, and I attempt to reach it with her help. It's a slow and torturous manoeuvre, with me clutching for dear life to Lorraine's arm. Sugar! I stub my little toe on some molten lava. I think it may be broken, so we head gingerly back to the steps. As I reach the safety of the edge, my legs are beginning to itch. I report my discomfort to Lorraine. Hers are too. By the time I haul my legs out of the Blue Lagoon, they look like two ripe polonies and the itch is intense. I want to rip them off. We head back to the showers like two overcooked lobsters. Was it the heat or the volcanic sand? No one else appears to be affected. After a long shower, the itchiness subsides slightly. I was worried our legs would implode and we wouldn't be allowed to fly. Can you fly with imploded limbs? A familiar cacophony greets us in the locker rooms. The American ice hockey team. Actually, they're very pleasant and quite concerned at the sight of our pins. One's offered to rub some linctus into them, but we pass on this kind offer. We hair-dried and put on our slap, ready for the journey back to the airport, took a few more pickies of number 13 in the lava fields and nicked a bit of volcanic rock. While we waited for the coach to the airport, Lorraine demonstrated an old family traditional method of drying wet swimwear. This involved wrapping it inside a towel, twisting it in a clockwise direction, while standing on a picnic table and whirling the entire contraption over one's head, something in the style of a Patagonian gaucho. It worked! Hurrah! Duty-free, I bought rich, dark 60% Austrian Stroh rum. Pug and I had tried this nectar some 30 years ago and not seen it since. Lorraine bought Black Death schnapps with shot glasses. We waited in the departure lounge with a voluble school party. Heathrow was chock-a-block with arrivals and we circled overhead for at least half an hour. I had the window seat. An unusually bumpy landing. I phoned the much-beloved while we waited for Lorraine's luggage to appear. I think it must have collie dog ancestry, as it was always last on the conveyor belt, rounding up all the others. We were met at arrivals by a delightful and very excited granddaughter, Brooke. She had been allowed to stay up and was full of it. We headed back to Kerry-Ann's via a good old British chippy. It was 9:45, but the chippy was shut and would not be persuaded by the two drunken males battering on the door to revise opening times. So we made for Kerry-Ann's and had red wine with leftover Chinese takeaway. perfect. As I lay in bed, my mind replayed the last brilliant 5 days with Lorraine and all the strange, peculiar and hilarious things we had encountered. I giggled out loud. Then I had the vision of an indignant, nay, bolshy Lorraine, sitting arms crossed, refusing to leave the bus, while I dangled from the footwell like a demented pole dancer. I pictured the immense church with the wrong time, happy Harrick, fierce Haitians, reindeer bulls, and the W.C. Road. I drifted off to sleep at about 1 a.m. probably. I even had the window seat. Thank you, Lorraine. Hurrah! And perfect! Jilly and I have since had more adventures, but that's another story.
That was such a fantastic time you both had, wasn't it, Lorraine? Can you remind us how long ago this was, and do you have a desire to revisit the places with Jilly?
Jilly and I went on our Icelandic adventure about 10 years ago. Reading Jilly's account of just a few days brought back many funny memories, along with the strange and wonderful sights, smells and tastes of Reykjavik. We've since been to Brittany many times, and always had adventures. Like the time we had stopped in a car park before boarding the ferry. Unfortunately, the car wouldn't start again, and we were helped to get going by, of all people, two young joyriders who realised we were in trouble. Who would have thought it? Anyway, now for an update on last month's fundraising concert.
Hello. Valerie, your chairman here. It gives me great pleasure to report on our Night of Nostalgia on the 18th of February at the Shaftesbury Theatre, Dawlish. It was really a fantastic evening. Well over 100 people attended and were rewarded with an evening of comedy, jokes and fantastic singing from both the performers and the audience. A real old-time music hall. All those taking part gave their services free, including our own John Townsend and Maggie West, who succeeded in getting the whole cast together. We are deeply indebted to these people. I'm pleased to announce that we have raised £1,053 from the ticket sales, the raffle and generous donations, which will ensure the continued existence of our local talking newspaper. So, a big thank you to everyone.
Talking of nostalgia, dear listener, here's a quiz for you. Not that we want any answers right now. How many of the following songs do you know and can sing or hum along to? Alfie, I Say a Little Prayer, Walk on By, The Look of Love, Magic Moments, I'll Never Fall in Love Again, They Long to Be Close to You, famously sung by Karen Carpenter, Best That You Can Do, from the film Arthur, That's What Friends Are For, On My Own, famously sung by Patti LaBelle and Michael McDonald, What's New Pussycat, sung by Tom Jones, of course. Always Something There to Remind Me, and What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. Did you know that these and numerous other memorable songs are by legendary lyricist Burt Bacharach and songwriter Hal David? I certainly didn't. I associated them with the singers that made the songs famous. Sadly, Burt Bacharach died last month at the age of 94. We conclude our programme with another of his famous songs, which I'm sure you know really well. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. sung by B.J. Thomas.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, and they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done. He's sleeping on the job, and those raindrops are falling on my head, and they keep falling. But there's one thing I know, the blues they send to greet me won't defeat me. It won't be long till happiness steps up to greet me. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. The cry is not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me. It won't be long till happiness steps up to greet me. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. The cry is not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining. 'Cause I'm free, nothing's worrying me.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins and her guest Kate Rue, Babs Astley, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Aileen Clarkson, John Townsend, and his guest Peter Smith.
Fran Frank, Lorraine Ferguson, her friend Jilly Pugsley, and Valerie Forrester.
Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Mike Smith.
From Lorraine and me,
goodbye.